I'm Nina Totenberg. This is The Connection. The order for airstrikes over Iraq. The announcement of the president's choice for the Supreme Court, Clarence Thomas. A green light for stem cells. All of these crucial decisions made by American presidents, not from the Oval Office, but from their vacation homes. Vacations say a lot about a president's image. JFK perpetuated the myth of Camelot with those touch football games at Hyannisport. And there was that Kodak moment with Clinton and Vernon Jordan in the golf cart on Martha's Vineyard during the Monica mess. Connection listeners, we are torpedoed with trivia about presidential vacations, but what kind of work do you expect a president to do while he's at play? Do your worries about the world take a holiday when he does? The number to call is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Or you can join us online at theconnection.org. And joining us from Washington are White House correspondents John King from CNN and Dana Milbank from The Washington Post. Also joining us from Washington is Stephen Hess, senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. And joining me in the studio is Alex Jones, director of the Shorenstein Center at the John F. Kennedy School of Government. Good morning, gentlemen.
Hey.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
John King, let me begin with you. You covered both President Clinton and now President Bush on vacation. It's hotter in Texas, but what else is different?
Oh, it's very different in their lifestyles. I should make clear for the record, I'm actually going to Crawford this week. I've been to Crawford twice before covering Bush. I have not been there on this vacation yet. I will be down there later this week, though. Very different. Clinton loved to golf. Clinton loved to be with the Hollywood folks who are up on Martha's Vineyard. Clinton was much more public on his vacation, although on this one, Bush has scheduled both some working events and he has made himself accessible before golf games, and he's chatted with reporters quite a bit. It's just stylistically, it's clear that Mr. Bush is quite comfortable spending the night on the ranch with his wife and perhaps one or two friends. Mr. Clinton liked to get out in public and mix it up a bit. That's a good way to put it.
How do they run their press operations? Do they run them pretty much the same? How busy do they try to keep you so that when they're in Crawford and when they were in the vineyard, for example, to keep you out of trouble?
Well, I think it's a conversation we'd be better having in about two more weeks to put it in total context, because with the stem cell decision, with the violence in the Middle East, with some other developments, there have been things for Mr. Bush to get into the mix about. I think when they began this vacation, they thought the stem cell decision would be the one big one, plus these day trips he's taking around the country, including two this week, but that the stem cell would be the one that captivated the country, the others more geared toward local press coverage. There's a much smaller press staff from the White House that takes these trips. A lot of the work is still done back in Washington. The National Security Advisor, for example, Condi Rice, was back in Washington. She actually took a few days off herself, God forbid, and took a bit of a vacation. So it's a much smaller scale White House that travels with the president to a vacation. But remember the day and age we live in, and the technology, the communications technology and other technology available not only to the president but to us in the news media. We can get our jobs done in this environment.
You know, it was interesting to me, Dana Milbank, when I looked back at the clips. First of all, Mr. Clinton didn't take terribly long vacations. I think his 1999 vacation was 8 days. But when I look back at the clips comparing Bush and Clinton, for example, what we were writing about with Clinton was the glitterati, but even more what the vacation was costing to pay for the Secret Service, to pay for the staff to be there and hotels, et cetera, et cetera. And with Bush, what we're writing about is the fact that, as the Washington Post put it, let's see if I can find this particular clipping, that he's spent, I think, 42% of his time on vacation, if you count all of his time to and from Crawford, Texas, or Camp David, so that we're sort of playing to type, aren't we, in the press?
Absolutely. I mean, the whole idea of Clinton's time in the White House was that the guy didn't even want to sleep. He was enjoying being president so much. The sort of caricature we have of President Bush is that of a slacker. Now, I don't believe that to be true particularly, but what happens is if you schedule a month-long vacation, even if he's working pretty hard there when we don't see him on the ranch, the caricature that's going to be put into place is one of a loafer.
Is he working pretty hard there on the ranch?
Well, is he working hard in his private time? Sure. Uh-huh. I mean, he has to keep track of everything that's going on in the government the same way he does when he's in the White House. I mean, when this president is in the White House, we were also writing stories about sort of early to bed and efficiency of decision making, 9-to-5 workday for the president. So this is sort of the caricature, whereas Clinton was a presidency of excess. Now we're the sort of the caricature is one of a minimalist.
Stephen Hess at the Brookings Institution, tell us when we first really began focusing on presidential vacations at all.
Well, you know, the president, with a few exceptions in the 19th century, wasn't running the show. It was Congress's show, with the exceptions of the Lincolns and the so forth of the world. So we didn't pay that much attention. I think we're... What happened, in a sense, was when President Eisenhower had a heart attack during a vacation, and Jim Haggerty, who was, I really think, the first great press secretary, turned it into a very amazing news giving event. I mean, they even gave out the reports on the president's bowel movements and so forth. And then Haggerty, I think, pretty much invented the idea of a working vacation, the idea that there would be enough information to keep a hungry press as busy as possible. So it's a fairly new concept, the attention paid to presidents' vacations, that they're really doing something. And of course, it is true that it's not like our getting in the car and driving to the Cape. He'll be in Milwaukee today, is it? And Missouri tomorrow, and so forth and so on. And it was pointed out, he does stay in touch constantly. And you know, Harry Truman called the White House a great white jail. And in some ways it's getting worse, thanks to the fact that we've had a lot of one assassination and a couple near assassinations in recent years. Pat Moynihan was telling me Saturday he had an appointment last week at the White House. He had trouble getting in. Well, gee, if you're 6'4" and have been around 24 years in the Senate and have trouble getting in, you start realizing that there is something.
And you're the co-chair of the Social Security Commission.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I was looking back, and when I was advising Jimmy Carter during the transition, and I was looking at a memo I sent him, and it said, a president should be able to walk in the woods on a weekend if it helps him restore his spirits or rethink his concerns. Herbert Hoover and John Kennedy were able to buy themselves rustic retreats, but should we have to count on a president being rich? And it says, go to Camp David. If you find it too opulent, so be it, but don't just dismantle it until you determine that it might serve some legitimate need. So I'm all for presidential vacations, especially when they really do stay in touch.
You know, I remember reading in Doris Kearns Goodwin's book, No Ordinary Times, I remember reading her description of how Roosevelt would make decisions when he was stuck, that one of the things that he would do is he would go off on his boat for a week or two and basically be incommunicado. I mean, yes, they could get hold of him if they wanted to, but he wanted to think. And that just isn't possible in that same way for a modern president, is it?
And let me add one thing, since I'm the only one of your four guests who's been on a White House staff. It's marvelous for the staff. You know, I mean, work is not equally divided in the government, and it's a chance both for very busy people to see their children and their spouses again, and also just to catch up on a lot of things that they keep pushing aside, but they're pretty important things. They're just not something that the president demands that they do tomorrow. So it works very well on that level, too, Nina.
So what do you think about the notion, though, that a president today simply cannot do that kind of solitary thinking, or can he if he really wants to?
Oh, sure. I think they can get away from it all. Ronald Reagan went out to his ranch, and I think nobody heard from him for days, that sort of thing. It's amazing how much they can get away, because the same thing that we talked about, this tremendous Secret Service protection that keeps other people away, certainly allows them to get something in. And you know, I remember way back, Herbert Hoover built Camp this camp in the Shenandoah, up on the Skyline Drive, a few cabins and so forth, that he'd go out fishing for trout there. He was totally alone, and a friend of mine had been out there a few years ago at fishing, and a park ranger came through, and my friend John Whitaker said, gee, you know, I haven't caught anything all morning, not even a nibble. Isn't this why Herbert Hoover put this place here? And the park ranger said, well, you see, sir, when he was president, the Secret Service stood at the head of the stream and dropped the trout in. You know, so it's a good life. People drop the trout in when you want to catch a fish.
I want to, Alex Jones from the Shorenstein Center, I want to read you something from, I think this is an editorial from the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, and it says that President Bush is following his father's example of frantic activity, jogging, brush cutting, fishing, all at a rapid pace. But Mr. Bush feasts. Special touch is that he's doing all of this, not in some idyllic resort, not even in the family retreat in Maine, but in one of the hottest, most miserable landscapes in America. This is the land that the Army chose to train its armored cavalry for hot, dusty warfare. This is the land that David Koresh chose for his apocalypse. But the whole of the Texas myth is closely tied to owning a ranch, and Mr. Bush believes, not surprisingly, not everyone else in his traveling party does. The staff is quartered in a double-wide mobile home. The press is quartered in Waco, writing grouchy stories about one-month vacations after 6 months in office and significantly longer than the average American annual getaway, and tying the modern record for presidential absence from the White House held by Richard Nixon. This is what happens, writes the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, when you're looking at a month's hard time in Waco. So is the problem really not George W. Bush, but the press just being bitchy about Waco?
I think that being bitchy about Waco is, you know, of a piece with being bitchy about planes, and to a certain extent being bitchy about covering the presidential vacation when there's just not much to report. And it's kind of frustrating for the people there because they're there to report mostly in some catastrophic situation, and they don't get to be vacationing. Often they're, when they were in Kennebunkport, were on a vacation spot, but they didn't get much vacationing in. I mean, the people who were working. And they were trying, on the other hand, to get on the air, and often you didn't get that either. But, you know, there's really something interesting to me about this whole idea of the presidents and their kinds of vacations. It strikes me that the thing I probably like very best about George W. Bush is that he seems to have a genuine affection for that little old house in Crawford. Have you ever seen a picture of that place? I haven't been down there. I'm basing it just on what it looks like. But that seems to be a place that he goes to for some genuine solace. And, you know, that the fact that he does have a place to go for solace is something that I don't think Bill Clinton ever actually had.
No, he didn't, because he didn't own a house.
He didn't have the temperament that allowed solace either. I mean, I don't mean that George Bush goes down there and thinks profound thoughts, but I think George W. Bush is not the type A kind of guy, as you pointed out, that Clinton is, but he does draw some kind of nourishment from being down there, clearly.
Hmm. John King, any final thoughts before we let you go about Bush and Texas?
Well, if you talk to senior staff members, people who worked with him during the campaign, they do say that he's a different person when he's there, that he is at ease. As the president himself said last week, it's a place where he goes to lift his spirits. He does seem to genuinely like the place, and I think we need to respect that. And on the subject of the editorial, I think there's way too much whining in our business. You can go to Waco. Nobody makes us do this for a living. We can do something else.
Okay, John King, thank you very much. The number to call is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Nina Totenberg, and you are listening to The Connection.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR News.
Connection listeners, we're talking about the politics and public fascination with presidential vacations this hour. My guests are Alex Jones, director of the Shorenstein Center at the JFK School of Government at Harvard, Dana Milbank, White House correspondent for The Washington Post, and Stephen Hess, senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. Alex Jones, let me start with you. You know, the truth of this matter is that what we in the press call these opportunities, if you want to call them that, are death watches.
They are.
Everybody's just terrified the president's going to have a heart attack, or somebody's going to shoot him, or some terrible thing is going to happen, or there's going to be a bomb go off in the Capitol and you're going to need instant reaction. But basically, we call them death watches, right?
Well, we do call them death watches, and they're usually just, as you say, for catastrophic moments to have somebody on scene. And I really think that one of the genuine turning points in the coverage, anyway, of presidential vacations was when George Bush Sr. was up at Kennebunkport and had the misfortune to be covered by Maureen Dowd, who at that time was a reporter, not a columnist for the New York Times, and had a withering eye for hilarious caricature. And she spotted the humor of watching George W. Bush Sr. race around from tennis to golf and playing golf and practically running from hole to hole and whatnot. And she managed to turn what was not intended to be something that would be newsworthy into something that belonged and appeared on the front page of the New York Times, written in a way to make the very habits of the president on vacation something of genuine news value, if only for its humor. And I think that in a funny way, Maureen set a standard that said, hey, you know, you can make something of this. And I think that reporters have been trying to make something of it ever since.
Well, there was the killer rabbit that preceded that. Remind us about the killer,
The killer rabbit was the nadir of the Jimmy Carter administration, I think, really. Losing the election probably didn't compare. What happened was that on one of his vacations, he was out he's a different kind of president. So his idea of a vacation always included not doing photo ops so much, but doing good and going sort of doing kind of a spiritual renewal and going to sort of spiritual retreat. So he was out paddling a canoe, I think, maybe followed by Secret Service, but he seems to have been alone. And he came back from this sort of solitary, contemplative moment saying that he had been attacked by a rabbit. And the rabbit had practically tried to jump into his canoe, and he'd had to beat it off with a paddle. Well, Jimmy Carter is the kind of man who I can't imagine making something like this up.
And anyway, he looks a little bit like a bunny himself.
Well, a chipmunk, I would say more. But that's a matter of judgment. But the thing was, he turned, unfortunately for himself, this rather dramatic. He was clearly spooked by this and scared, and he came back, and of course people were lampooning this. This is back in the days of I don't know whether Johnny Carson was still on, but I can remember the Tonight Show series on the attack rabbit was sort of unending. It just went on and on and on.
Dana Milbank, when you're sitting there on this death watch, and you do have to sort of justify your existence, what do you do?
Well, Nina, I wish it were more of a death watch. I just came back yesterday from a week down there expecting I'd get lots of time to lounge by the pool and, make sure my pager doesn't go off. But I wound up writing a story every day. We had to have him responding to the Middle East a couple of days. The head of his faith-based office quit. They were having all these battles on the Hill with the shrinking surplus. He jetted off to Colorado for a day, in New Mexico for a day to do education and environmental events. I didn't have any time to be writing about how fast he's playing golf or whether he's being attacked by rodents.
Do you think they moved up the stem cell decision because he was getting so much publicity about the length of the vacation? I mean, initially that decision had been, the indications were it was going to come at the end of August. And there's, and there's a strong suspicion it got moved up to change the subject.
Yeah, I think a lot of people have a strong suspicion. We don't know for sure about that. But what's definitely clear is they're trying to add, it was always a working vacation, but they're emphasizing working a lot more. In fact, I wrote one day last week that he'd taken a break from his vacation, in effect, to go to Albuquerque. And I got a note from one of the White House people saying, how can you say it's a vacation if he's working in Albuquerque? And I said, well, the president said today in Albuquerque that he was on vacation. So that's how I can say it. But I think, I think they've planned a whole lot of things. First of all, obviously, by shortening it by a few days so it doesn't exceed President Nixon's record of the longest vacation, that must reflect some sensitivity there. And they've planned a whole bunch of other events. We may get a new announcement of a chairman of the Joint Chiefs. But the idea is very much to show that the government continues to function. And obviously it does. It's not exactly clear whether the president has a lot to do with any of these things, but clearly the government's still functioning.
I've wondered, when I look at some of the video on the tube at night of him sort of on the golf course, for example, talking about the Middle East mid-swing, mm-hmm. whether this really does him any good or not. And this isn't just about George Bush. This is about any president talking about something as serious as the Middle East who's sort of doing it while aw-shucksing around with a tennis racket or a golf mm-hmm. club or, what do you think?
Then we got him doing the Middle East in a classroom and doing the Middle East while picking up some corn on the cob. It is a strange sort of notion of sort of golf course diplomacy. In fact, the day that the president made his remarks on the golf course, the first thing he said is, "Ask me that later. I'm having a bill signing back at the House." I think he did not want to be there, in his sweaty golf shirt, talking about death in the Middle East. So I think he is sensitive to that. On the other hand, that's where people are able to spot him. We can't just walk onto the ranch. In fact, I wasn't on the ranch an entire time the whole week I was there. So that the only time that they allow him to be visible to us is when we're going to fire the questions at him.
The number to call is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Now, during the Clinton presidency, there was a lot of telephoto lens activity, trying to get pictures of the president and Mrs. Clinton, for example. And there was some debate as to whether who got the better of whom, whether cameramen were ingenious or whether they were meant to be ingenious and get some of these photos. What about at the Bush Ranch?
Well, I'm thinking now of the photo of them, President Clinton and the First Lady in their bathing suits
right.
dancing on the beach. There certainly was none of that this week. This is, 500 or more acres? You can't get anywhere near the place.
Mm-hmm.
You can drive your car along the road outside. Not that you could see anything from there, but you can't even stop your car. So there is complete seclusion there. I mean, nobody's seen hide nor hair of the First Lady this entire trip. So I think it's much more controlled that we'll see the president when he wants to be seen, and that is, signing an agriculture bill or out there on the golf course or reading to some second graders. But this is true of this administration in general, that they're all very effective at sort of controlling the image we see of the president. But this one, I think, has reached much more of a high art in that.
Steve Hess, they may be effective at controlling the image, but did they even bother to try 25 years ago?
Sure, I think they did. That's changed only in degree. After all, the president is the chief politician of the United States. He acts in a political capacity all the time. All his decisions have to take that into account. Let me say something, Nina, because there's a sense, or part of a sense in the conversation, that the press, following the president, is a very unhappy lot. They're desperate for a story, and they're not getting their story, or so forth and so on. But remember, if you're not in Crawford, Texas, or Plains, Georgia, as Alex pointed out, some of these vacation spots, whether it's Kennebunkport or Hyannis Port or Santa Barbara San Clemente, are very nice places. And you slow down, the press can slow down a bit too. In many cases, of course, they do send a backup person and let their number one person take a little vacation as well. So it's a quasi holiday in many cases. For the press as well, and I don't think we should shed too many tears for the poor working reporter who's not always getting that great story.
I agree. I think Steve's absolutely right. And what's happening with Waco is it's not so much the vacation; it's the location of the vacation.
Yeah.
If you ask the people who live in Waco, and I say, "What are you doing this summer?" I say, "Well, we go to the coast. We go to Corpus Christi or Galveston." Nobody in Waco vacations in Waco. Vacationing in Waco in the wintertime is a fabulous idea. What a terrific way to stay warm and eat barbecue.
Well, what do you make of the decision of George Bush to love being there in August? Why do you think he likes it?
It's 102 degrees there. He's clearing brush in 102 degrees.
I mean, is he an ascetic of some kind?
It's home to the heartland, and it's almost like there's some virtue in the suffering of it, I think. And it's like he is showing that he is a hardy man, that he wants to go out on a heat run when it's 102. Maybe it's showing a bit of the sort of Kennedy-esque vigor of it. But it's sort of an endurance contest, and I think he has a good bit more endurance than those of us following him and even the Secret Service agents trying to run with him.
And also, let me add, one story that I think the press didn't follow to the fullest was his medical examination, the physical he took a couple weeks ago, where it turns out, look at those figures. I mean, he has a heart rate that's better than two-thirds of the Georgia Tech football team. when he's out cutting brush, it's more appropriate for him than most other 55-year-olds.
I think it's 43 at rest. That's his pulse, 43 at rest. And most professional athletes have a pulse rate of 50 at rest.
Well, you know, maybe I've missed something, but when did George Bush become such a physical culturist?
Miss something.
When did it happen?
He exercised.
No, what I mean, I know that he does that now, but I mean, my image of him in the past was as a sort of, you know, country club guy with a scotch in his hand. And all of a sudden, he became somewhere along the line, maybe while he was governor, maybe before, I don't know. But do we know when he became a guy who was so really, you know, I mean, he obviously takes a huge amount of his time every day to work out. He's in a position. I'm reminded of that photograph of Jimmy Carter running in the heat. Remember that? And he looked like he was about to have a stroke. And he was also, you know, sort of driven man like this. But, I mean, where does this come from?
That's a good question, because he was, you know, the stickball commissioner and a cheerleader at Andover. He wasn't.
No, I mean,
he wasn't just the person.
This has not always
on.
Been this way. Kind of.
Well, he was an intramural athlete, but you remember the story that the morning he decided to give up drinking. This was sometime in the mid '80s, and he went out for a run to sort of sweat it out, and that's when he decided that he would give up drinking and clean up. I think that's very much sort of the point. It became much more of focusing on improving his health than on destroying it. And, yeah, I mean, he was running marathons when he was in the governor's office, and this is certainly not a new thing for him.
Anybody who can be exercising regularly at 11:30 in the morning has got a better schedule than I do. The number to call is 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK, and we have a call from Bob in Williamsburg, Virginia. Go ahead, Bob.
Two brief comments that your co-workers there can reflect on afterwards. One is that vacations are not just a problem for American presidents. It was a great PR problem a year ago for President Putin of Russia when he remained on vacation while his submarine, the Kursk, was going down.
Good point.
The second is that I didn't vote for Bush. I'm not a fan of his, but I want to be fair. When last year at the end of the election, we expected him to work very hard in putting his administration together before the inauguration. And we complained because they didn't have enough time to do it. We expect them to work very hard doing that, and we don't pay them for that. He gets no presidential salary during all that time, and that's a time when, after a hard campaign, you'd expect maybe they need a vacation, but they have to work real hard, and we expect that, and we don't pay them for it.
Steve Hess, I don't think these guys do this job for the money.
No, I don't think they do either. And in fact, I noticed there's some sort of little movement to take away presidential pensions because now they don't seem to need it. They can write their memoirs. Of course, there's no means test on it. But it was strange that the Gallup poll came out and showed that a majority of Americans take offense at George W. Bush taking a month's vacation, whether it's a working vacation or not. And maybe that's because most of us only get a two-week vacation, or maybe it's because we pay somebody $400,000 of our money. We think they should be working 365 days a year for it. But I think there's been a reaction, at least this year, to presidential the president taking the vacation. And I that displeases me a little. I'm sorry about that. I don't think we're being shortchanged. We may be shortchanged otherwise because we don't agree of how well he's doing or whether we agree with him in general. But I think we shouldn't begrudge him this sort of opportunity to get away from Washington.
Steve Hess, do you think that that part of this is the sort of feeling that people have that they're more beleaguered than ever? They have to work harder than ever. They, you know, are taking, you know, two jobs, both everybody in the family working like mad, that this is, you know, sort of excessive because simply people in this country have had to ratchet up their whole work habit scenario?
It may well be. It may well be the way the question was phrased, you know, the pollster's question. And they said, "Is it? Do you object to the president taking a 30-day vacation as opposed to shouldn't presidents get off from work like the rest of us or something?" People might respond differently to it. But that may be true. If this was taken in the go-go days a couple years ago, maybe people would feel otherwise. I think that your point is quite correct, in that the feeling toward all institutions, whether it's the presidency, whether it's the Congress, whether it's the press for that matter, go up or down on how good they're feeling. And in good times, these institutions get higher ratings. In bad times, the ratings go down.
I wonder how much of it has to do with us in the press. And I don't mean just complaining about Waco. In that we have, you know, 65 news channels now, and they all have to have something to talk about. Mm-hmm. And at the moment, there's not a lot to talk about aside from the Middle East. And if you were going to cover the White House, the thing that you obviously are going to cover is that the president is taking a relatively lengthy vacation. And so you sort of do variations on a theme by vacation. And that it then becomes, you know, we've made it into an issue.
Well, when I was at the New York Times, I can tell you that come August, all the backlog of stories that had been sitting around for all those months all of a sudden found their way in. And I can remember having editors come up practically pleading for something to put in the paper because they, you know, the cupboard was bare. And I think you've got a point. I think that it's not just in August, it's throughout the summer this sort of goes down in newspapers as well as cable television.
You know, Clinton had Monica. We wouldn't shut up about Monica. Poor George True. Bush has his vacation. The number to call is 1-800-423-8255. And we'll come back with calls in a minute. You're listening to The Connection on National Public Radio.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR News Station.
We're talking about politics and PR of the presidential R&R. Join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're talking with Stephen Hess, Senior Fellow at the Brookings Institution, Alex Jones, Director of the Shorenstein Center at Harvard's John F. Kennedy School of Government and formerly at the New York Times, and also with Dana Milbank, White House Correspondent for the Washington Post. The number to call, again, is 1-800-423-8255. Alex, let me ask you and maybe Steve Hess as well. I'll start with you, Alex. What do you think that vacations tell us about the person that's taking them, and do they tell us?
Well, I think they really do tell you something. Maybe this is sort of, hip pocket psychoanalysis, and I don't give it any real weight terribly. But if you look at it as the human needs dimension of if the president puts on his pants one leg at a time, as we know he does, he has the need for rest. There's no question about that. And how the president chooses to find that rest, it would seem to me, says a lot about the kind of person he is. The image that I have, rightly or wrongly, of Richard Nixon on vacation is sitting in a room either alone brooding or with some cronies and a glass of scotch and water in his hand with some ice cubes clinking and basically drinking himself into a nice, pleasant stupor. I don't know whether that's true or not, but that's sort of the image that I have of him as a solitary kind of man. I think that, you know, the other aspect of being a human being and a president is the sexual one, and I think we've seen what the problem that can bring, obviously, in the last administration. But I think that these things go hand in hand. I mean, you can't expect a president not to have these needs and not to have them satisfied in some way. And the thing that I worry most about is that the sort of expectations now of the job, the demands for the public side of the vacation aspect of it especially, are going to deprive the president of the rest, of whatever form it needs to be taken. I mean, Bill Clinton thrives in crowds, as you pointed out. I think that I think that itch needs to be scratched, and I don't quite know what George W. Bush's itch is. I hope it's being scratched, though, for all our sakes.
Steve Hess?
No, that was very, very nicely put. I don't think that I have much to add to it. Presidential vacations are very much a continuation. Of course, it is true, as I mentioned before, most of these folks are pretty well-to-do. They go back to their ranches. They go back to their compounds. And then they perform with their friends and families much the way they always did. There was Hyannisport, and we know about the Kennedys and sailing. And perhaps a little wenching too, but that wasn't advertised in the press in those days. Poor Bill Clinton, who didn't have a place to go back to, and was sort of a nomad, looking for a rich friend who would lend him his compound.
Not just lend him the compound, but vacate the compound.
One of the things
that the Clintons always had as a prerequisite was they didn't want to be somebody's guest and having to entertain them every night. They wanted the compound.
And the saddest part of the whole Clinton 8 years was that 1995, when Dick Morris had to sort of invent by focus group and poll what the president should be doing for his rest and relaxation, and determine that the year before election he should be out in the wilds in a national park. A poor man never wanted that. He wanted to be on Martha's Vineyard and having some fun with the glitterati, and that was sort of sad, and it did tell us something I think about Bill Clinton and his needs.
The number to call is 1-800-423-8255, and Peter is on the line. Go ahead, Peter.
Hi, Nina. Beverly Hills got its name from a presidential vacation. Back when Burton Green had a field of lima beans that he was going to develop, he read about President Taft vacationing in Beverly Farms, Massachusetts, and thought that that was a good name, and so they named Beverly Hills after Beverly Farms, Massachusetts.
I didn't know that.
I didn't know that either.
That's a great piece of trivia. Thank you, Peter.
You're welcome.
And we have Tim on the line. Go ahead, Tim.
Hi.
Go ahead.
I just wanted to offer my opinion that the issue isn't that, you know, he's taking 30 days vacation in a year. I think if he took, you know, a week's vacation every quarter or something like that, that would be fine. But 30 days is an awful long time to be away from the post of the president of the U.S. There's a lot of things. You know, the Mideast is about to erupt. The economy's gone to crap. And, you know, I think people they think 30 days is excessive. If he took a week off to recharge his batteries, everybody'd understand. But 30 days is a 12th of the year. And it's not like we don't expect him to take Christmas off and stuff like that. So.
You know, it's interesting concept. I wonder what it would be like if he just went incognito, totally, you know, into his own world for a week, didn't show up, didn't hold press conferences, really was totally on vacation.
And to recharge and say,
yeah,
he's got to recharge his batteries.
Yeah, he could cut brush pressure until he passed out.
Yeah, whatever he wants to do. It's a high pressure job. There's a lot of demands. Everybody would understand that he needs to take a break. But how can he take a break 30 days in and then not do anything for the next 11 months? That doesn't that doesn't really justify the 30 days in the first place. It must not be too high pressure of a job if you can go 11 months without a break.
Well, Dana Milbank from the Washington Post, the Post actually did a computer run on how much time President Bush has taken off.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm reading here, civil service rookies get 4 hours of vacation time for every two-week pay period, which they can use as soon as the hours begin accumulating. Since January 21st, Inauguration Day, with Bush on the job, the rough equivalent of 13 pay periods, he should be eligible for 6.5 days at his Texas ranch. But, in fact, if you count all the time he spent in Kennebunkport and everything else, according to the Washington Post, he spent 42% of his presidency either on vacation or going to or from vacation. You think that's a little extreme on the part of the Post to calculate it that way?
Well, the White House didn't dispute those numbers. I mean, the only question is, do you count partial days as vacation days or work days? So that's where you can fiddle with the numbers. You know, the solution to this may be to stop calling this thing a vacation and let's call it a presidential recess. Nobody's complaining that the Congress is out of session. In fact, we're delighted when Congress is out of session. Everybody figures they can't do any trouble then. The Supreme Court has been out all summer. They have a quite a lenient schedule, and nobody's complaining about that. They're having junkets all over the world. So perhaps we should he should declare a recess and just leave Dick Cheney in charge. He doesn't need a break.
The difference between the Supreme Court, the Congress, and so forth is the difference, again, we go back to the press corps. You know, there is the White House press corps, 60 reporters sitting there with nothing else to follow but the president. That's his story. Maybe we should just give a recess to the White House press corps, Dana.
I second that. Hardly.
Well, let me,
with expenses paid
like
to Europe.
Like the tree falling in the forest. Well, no one is there.
Along the lines of the vacation saying something about the character, what is Dick Cheney's idea of a vacation?
He goes fishing. I know.
Yeah, he's
he
off.
Fishing.
He's off in Wyoming right now.
I don't know for how long, but he does.
He doesn't
go fishing.
Strike me as a fisherman. He just doesn't look like a fisherman somehow.
Hmm?
Well, you know, a lot of presidents have been fishermen. In fact, a couple of years ago, a fellow wrote up in New England wrote a book on presidential fishermen. Asked me to do a blurb on it. I said, a nation whose presidents have been fishermen can't be all bad. It's a very nice contemplative sort of a thing to do. Dwight Eisenhower was a great fisherman. I thought well of him for that. And so I rather think that may be the number one.
Walter Mondale
for presidents over time.
Walter Mondale, who never made it to president, obviously, but made it to vice president, used to love to go ice fishing, which is where you cut a hole in the ice and sit around with your buddies drinking beer.
Yeah, and see, there's a big difference in ice fishing and, say, fly fishing.
Right,
which
because
is,
in ice fishing, it's not the fish, it's the talk.
Yeah.
You know, and that's what he said when
and
I
it's
said,
like
why
you
would
wanna,
you want to do
You don't
want
to have your fishing trip interrupted by fish. You
right.
Know,
I mean, that's just the excuse for being there. The number to call is 1-800-423-8255. And let's see, Bill is on the line. Go ahead, Bill.
Hello?
Go ahead.
Oh, yeah. I just wanted to say a few minutes ago, just before the break, you mentioned that there was very little else to cover. And I just wanted to take issue with that. I mean, it seems that this focus on the president takes away coverage of a lot of other important issues. I mean, ranging from the details of the various policies that he's supporting to the world at large. I mean, anything from the mutual agreement on investment, the free trade, the issues raised by the protests at the WTO meetings. And I just wanted to make a point that there are lots of things going on that, for reasons that I can't necessarily fathom, the media don't cover.
Well, let me tell you a dirty little secret. Reporters go on vacation, too.
No, I understand that. And they should. But I just mean to say that when they're not on vacation, there are many things that should be covered that are not covered in the detail that I think they warrant. And that's the point I wanted to make. I don't know what comments anyone else might want to make.
I think there's no question about what you're saying, and I think it's especially true of television.
Oh, yeah, certainly. Certainly.
But I also think that television and newspapers know they're catering in the summer and in August in particular to people who are paying less attention than usual.
That's true.
I mean, I just came back from 2 weeks in Maine where I didn't even read the newspaper every day. I'm pleased to admit. It's a real vacation.
You know, I once did a, I was doing a show called On the Media on radio, and we did a panel on what reporters do about news themselves when they go on vacation, and an astonishing number of them absolutely avoid news at all costs.
It's wonderful. It's just wonderful. It's like the rest of the world lives. It's just terrific. The number to call is 1-800-423-8255, and we're going to go now to line one, which is Donna calling from Columbia, South Carolina.
Hi, this is Donna, and I would just like to make a quick comment that we are making a big deal about how long the president spends in Crawford, Texas. But in reality, the president is always the president, and it doesn't matter if he's in Kennebunkport or Camp David or Crawford, Texas. He is still the president, and he still has to carry on that responsibility. And he can work from wherever he needs to be or from wherever he wants to be.
Well, that's certainly even truer in this day and age. You know, when an old crone like me started out, it was a big deal when President Kennedy, for example, could get advanced texts of his speeches to reporters on the traveling press plane. And times have certainly changed. I mean, between the computer and the fax machine and the instant duplication and the
cell phones.
Cell phones. The traveling White House is instantly movable. Steve Hess, does that change anything in terms of staff, in terms of anything?
Oh, I couldn't agree with the caller more. The president is totally in touch. Count on it. Most of the rest have to do with perception and spin. Should the president rush back if there's a crisis in Washington, or can't he handle it just as well from Crawford, Texas? That sort of thing. They're in touch, and our caller's got it just right.
Anybody else want to chime in on this?
Well, the president gets his daily security briefing just as he gets when he's back in the White House. He's in touch with foreign leaders just as he is when he's in the White House. And the truth is, it's not as if he doesn't go exercise on the gym equipment when he's in the White House, just as he's doing when he's down there in Waco.
Well, I would like to put in a vote for more isolation for the president rather than less, and give him more. I mean, I think that this president, you know, you set your pace, I think, according to what you really realize you need. And George W. Bush clearly needs time. He doesn't meditate, but he gets on the treadmill a lot. So
This is sort of an infrastructure problem. The president wants, expects, and demands to be in every news cycle. Any president does when he's busy, when the Congress is in session. He wants to be able to dominate the debate. So we have this huge White House press corps to respond to that infrastructure. Then it disappears, but we're still there.
Okay, gentlemen, thank you so much. Presidential historian Stephen Hess, Dana Milbank, White House correspondent for The Washington Post, Alex Jones, director of the Shorenstein Center at Harvard's John F. Kennedy School of Government, and earlier we talked with John King, White House correspondent for CNN. Thank you all. The Connection is produced by Graham Smith, Sean Carberry, Sarah Field, Kelly Jones, Allison McAdam, Lindsay Miller, Christina Russo, Karen Schiffman, and Doug Sugertz. Today, our senior producer is Tara Murphy. To continue the Presidential Vacation Connection, you can go to our website, theconnection.org. I'm Nina Totenberg, and this is The Connection.
This is WBUR. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by the Kaiser Family Foundation.